KLOS HD1, Los Angeles. This is the rock of Southern California. Now, shining a light on the people, organizations, and events that bring Southern Californians together. This is Spotlight on the Community with your host, Doug McIntyre.
Ladies and gentlemen, for a very long time, we've been putting a lot of attention on the opioid crisis in this country. The amazing resurgence of heroin. The governor of the state of Vermont a couple of years ago used the entire state of the state address to talk about one topic, heroin. A lot of people were saying, what's that about? Well, it's not just about Philip Seymour Hoffman and celebrities. It's about a scourge that has returned with a vengeance. And the Cincinnati Inquirer has done a remarkable piece of investigative reporting. They dedicated 60 reporters and photographers and videographers that were sent out into the community. And they picked one week, just any week. It happened to be the week of July 10th through the 16th, to go out and cover what happens related to drug overdoses. And the numbers came out in this one particular week to 18 fatalities, 180 overdoses, more than 200 heroin users in jail, and 15 babies born with heroin-related medical problems. It's a 20-page special report. I encourage you to read it at the Cincinnati Inquirer website, and there's a lot of video components, too. It's well worth your time, and everybody should be up to speed on what's going on in this country related to opioids and heroin. And joining us right now is one of the reporters involved in this, and it's a pleasure to welcome to the show from the Cincinnati Inquirer, Terry DeMeo. Terry, how are you?
Just fine. Thank you so much for having me tonight.
This is a great piece of work. And one of the things that struck me is that you are the Cincinnati Inquirer's heroin epidemic reporter, that the newspaper has devoted the resources to have somebody whose job it is to just cover heroin addiction. And I think that's telling in and of itself.
Yeah, this was the decision of Peter Bhatia, our editor, in January of 2016. I had been covering the epidemic for about 4 years prior to that, as I could. And we had an extraordinary number of overdose deaths in Ohio as well as in neighboring northern Kentucky. And he said, let's just do it this way. Let's do it in the way that he considered to be the right way.
Well, a lot of folks have read Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance, which is still a bestseller. And J.D. Vance has roots in Kentucky but grew up in Middletown, Ohio. And Middletown, Ohio is sort of the crossroads of the heroin slash opioid trafficking in the country. And, you know, you can't get any more middle America than Middletown, Ohio, but it's sort of indicative of the magnitude of the crisis that's just been quietly percolating and now I don't think can be ignored anymore.
I agree. Yeah. We've had several little idyllic communities, including Middletown, that, you know, have been inundated with heroin and now fentanyl-laced heroin and carfentanil, the elephant opioid. It's been for years now. And people who had been addicted primarily to prescription painkillers were, of course, the victims of this. But we see this across every economic strata. You know, I know it's starting to sound cliche, but this disease really does not discriminate. And yes, we've been hit particularly hard in Ohio.
Why do you think Ohio, I mean, I know that what it's been postulated that one of the reasons is because of the nexus of interstate highways that enables the drug trade to go east, west, and north, south, right through the middle of Ohio and into the Canada, for that matter. But have you got any insights into why does Ohio seem to be the capital of this problem, or is it just related to the road system, transportation?
The road system is primary, but for years we've had, especially an Appalachian community, and, you know, really others, industrial workers who have been prescribed painkillers for job-related, work-related injuries. We also, just like everyone else, have our share of young student athletes who get an injury and get this kind of prescription, and anyone who went to a dentist might. But in Ohio, I think it was clear to the Mexican drug cartels that we had already had this issue of prescription painkiller addiction, and we had pill mills where people would stand in line to get new prescriptions and new pills. As you know, we were just inundated with it. And then our governments began to see the difficulty and the problems with this addiction and cut off a lot of the, that which was causing it, these pill mills. Doctors stopped prescribing as many prescriptions as they had been. People were looking for an alternative, and heroin was on the streets and cheap, and that's what happened.
We're talking with Terry DeMeo, who's the heroin epidemic reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and you can follow Terry on Twitter at TDeMeo, D-E-M-I-O, D-E, the letter T, D-E-M-I-O, and Cincinnati.com. Please take a couple of minutes. You'll fall in and you'll spend quite a few minutes reading the whole thing and watching the video attachments, but it's worth going to the Inquirer website and checking out this incredible piece of journalism. This is what newspapers do best. It's such an important story. Let me ask you what's an uncomfortable question, but in looking at the video component and certainly reading J.D. Vance's book some months ago, this heroin epidemic seems to be a white person's problem. It's not that there aren't African-Americans who are addicted to heroin, but this current incarnation of it, whether it's Vermont or Middletown, Ohio, seems to be, and I'm looking at the video component, man, there's a lot of strung out white people here. Is there a difference what is the cultural difference, if I'm not, hopefully I'm not inventing an issue, but what's the difference between black substance abuse and this white substance abuse problem that seems to be involved in the opioid and heroin addiction?
Well, a lot of these people, about 75% of people who are currently addicted to heroin, really did start with the prescription painkillers. And I have learned that because so much of our population, that became addicted, was of a suburban nature, people with health insurance, people who went to doctors, people who sought help, sought treatment. It kind of became a white scourge. And we still do have, obviously, as you said, the black community who is greatly impacted, but it is largely a white suburban, rural, and now back to urban health crisis. And I think, too, that because families whose children, adult children, have become addicted have been they're enfranchised people. They are people who seek out their legislators and ask for help and ask for attention and hold their children out there, my honor student, my football player student, whomever. I think that it got more attention.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think, the evolution of this scourge.
The ripple effect, the social dysfunction that follows from an addict in a family, and it's usually, am I making this up or would it be accurate to say that if a partner ends up addicted, it's not uncommon for both partners in a relationship to end up addicted?
That's correct. Yeah. And, it spills out over their children, their entire families. We've had communities in which, you can walk for blocks and see people who all know each other, and many of them are addicted to heroin.
And the downward spiral, once people are addicted to something as powerfully addictive as heroin, it takes over their lives and it starts to morph into child neglect, then child abuse. The people, you know, they're so obsessed with their next fix and sating the monkey on their back that they stop maintaining their house. They stop working or work, let's put it this way, becomes erratic. And you just start to see the entire, you know, fabric of society start to collapse family by family.
That's absolutely correct. This is a disorder of the brain. And so what you have once someone is addicted is someone who is compelled to continue to seek that drug at all costs, at any cost, and the inability to stop. I have never met someone in deep addiction who said, I want this life. I don't care. I don't care about my children. No, I don't see that. But if in their moments of clarity where they want to get help, they do not receive appropriate help immediately, they just don't get it because they are, their brain has been rewired to this compulsive seeking and using. And in addition to that, as I think everybody knows, when someone is in withdrawal, it feels like they're dying. They may know rationally they are not going to die, but it feels as if they are dying, and they use the drug then to feel normal. It is not about getting high any longer, any recreational purpose. It is to feel normal.
We're talking with Terry DeMeo, who is the heroin epidemic reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. We have a link, by the way, to this excellent piece on our Facebook page. So if you're a follower of ours, McIntyre in the Morning at Facebook.com, you can link it that way. You certainly can go to Cincinnati.com, Cincinnati Inquirer website, which is part of the USA Today network. This is just a blockbuster piece that everybody should be familiar with so that you understand what's going on out there. And, you know, whenever we cover here in Los Angeles, Terry, we certainly have a heroin and opioid crisis as well. And we also have an enormous homeless problem. We're the homeless capital of North America. And there is a nexus between the opioid heroin addiction crisis and L.A.'s homeless, California's homeless problem, too. Because once people fall into this downward spiral, they really become they go feral to a certain extent, and they can't live within the normal confines of a family. A lot of times they break the family ties because it's not safe for people to have them in the house anymore, around kids, around grandma and grandpa, et cetera. And as I mentioned before, the entire fabric that holds society together collapses. But in L.A., we've now thrown enormous resources at the homeless problem. What is the state of Ohio doing to combat this? Because this is an undeniable pandemic.
Yeah, well, we have a lot of people who, you know, legislators that are proposing and passing laws that will help with treatment. Finally, medication-assisted treatment, which is the best practice form of treatment for opioid addiction. We have lots of volunteer groups and heroin task forces who are doing kind of boots on the ground outreach and coaching those who reach and are with those who are using heroin. And we have, you know, numerous social services agencies and even jails that are now seeing this.
Yeah, the jails have to be a part of it because that's usually the first point of contact is law enforcement. Terry, thank you so much for coming on with us. We'll continue to follow the story, and it's obviously congratulations to the Inquirer for committing the resources to cover this story at such a granular level. It's important. It's important work. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. You take care.
Okay. So the president cut a deal with Nancy Pelosi and Charles Schumer of New York, the Democratic leadership, over the extension of the debt ceiling. And last night he had dinner at the White House with Nancy Pelosi and Charles Schumer, and one of the issues on the table was DACA. Initially, there were reports from Schumer and Pelosi that a deal had been struck on the Dream Act kids. The president this morning tweeted out no deal was made last night on DACA. To talk about this and so much more, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show Congressman Tom McClintock. Good morning, Congressman. How are you?
Good morning, Doug. Thanks for having me back.
Appreciate it. So what do you make of last night's dining with Donald?
Well, first, I can't blame the president for talking to Chuck Schumer. He runs the Senate, and he runs the Senate because Senate Republicans have made a conscious, deliberate decision not to reform their cloture rule, which gives any member the ability to block virtually any bill, and until they can come up with 60 votes, the bill can't move forward. That gives Schumer veto control over all legislation going through the Senate. That is a conscious decision by Mitch McConnell and the Senate Republicans, and that is where the blame lies.
Now, the cloture rule, this is sort of inside politics stuff. The cloture rule has been around a very, very long time, and it was originally instituted to stimulate debate specifically on issues of major importance. In other words, if it's a routine piece of legislation, no harm, no foul. But when you're talking about passing a piece of legislation that can remake society, the idea was to have a full, open, and vigorous debate so that we don't make capricious changes to America without really airing out the issue. So we wanted a supermajority, 60 votes out of 100 in the Senate. But what that has done now is
to close debate.
Right, to end debate before a vote. But what it has led to instead is that virtually any member of the United States Senate who wants to throw the monkey wrench into it can simply file papers with the president pro tem of the Senate, and then it'll never be heard. There'll be no debate. It actually ends debate.
As you point out, the principle is sound. If a significant minority wants to continue to discuss an issue, they ought to continue to discuss the issue. But that assumes that it's an actual debate between real people regarding the merits of the subject that's directly at hand. What cloture has become is a ministerial function that any member can use to block a bill from being heard. So the irony is, a motion that was originally designed to protect debate has now degenerated into a motion that very effectively prevents debate. And this is a conscious decision of the Senate Republicans to maintain that change in the cloture rule. Now, by the way, they're not required to do that. They reformed it for the nomination of Neil Gorsuch, but they've chosen not to reform on major legislation. 2 weeks before the two weeks after the election, I went to the House floor and I warned that the single greatest obstacle to the president's agenda is the cloture rule in the Senate, and that Senate Republicans had to reform it. They haven't, and this is the result.
And as a general rule, as inspiring and as informative as your speech may have been on the floor of the House, the Senate usually doesn't want the House meddling in how the Senate runs their business. In fact, they don't want anybody meddling in how they run their business.
Here's the problem. When the Senate is dysfunctional, and this cloture rule has made it dysfunctional, then the Congress cannot act. The House has passed major legislation over to the Senate on everything from health care reform to regulatory relief, the Choice Act that rolls back the Dodd-Frank regulations that are absolutely killing our community banks. It would be $1 trillion of regulatory relief, according to one estimate. All of that's gone over to the Senate, and all of it has died because of the Senate Republicans' refusal to reform their cloture.
Well, let me ask you this.
So we can't do our jobs in the House because the Senate's not doing its job. Both houses have to agree before legislation can go to the president.
Why? The obvious question is why? Why does Mitch McConnell not want to see legislation move through? He's a legislator.
I've asked him that question, and his response was, well, it was very helpful when we were in the minority to block bad legislation. And my point is, well, yes, it's helpful in blocking bad legislation. It's also very, very effective at blocking good legislation, and you're going to need to decide whether you want to be a successful majority or a successful minority, because you cannot be a successful majority with that rule in place. And if you think for a second that Chuck Schumer and the Democrats are going to extend the same courtesy for you, you are sadly mistaken. They made it very clear when they thought they were going to win the Senate last year that they were going to reform that cloture rule. So the reasoning behind this that's been expressed to me by Mitch McConnell simply doesn't hold any water.
We're talking with Congressman Tom McClintock at Rep. McClintock. Congressman, let's talk about DACA. As you know, we've discussed the immigration issue a million times back from the days when you were in the state Senate. And I am really afraid that President Trump will make a deal with Nancy Pelosi and Charles Schumer that divorces the DACA issue from border security, from the rest of border security, all the myriad issues that must be addressed. And if he does so, I think we'll be replicating the blunders of the Simpson-Mazzoli bill, which promised for amnesty for 2.7 million people, tougher security. Mm-hmm. We got the amnesty. We didn't get the tougher security. And I think the only leverage that we really have right now with the Democrats, not with the American public, but with the Democrats, is the DREAM Act, because most people, myself included, want to see that fixed. But if you offer that as a clean bill, separate from actual substantive border security, we'll never see it. We'll have an amnesty, and that's it.
You are exactly right, and we've heard this song before. As you said, in 1986, it was supposed to be amnesty and border enforcement. We got the amnesty. We never saw the border enforcement. That's why it has to be in one bill, and that bill, first and foremost, has to complete restoring the integrity of our borders and the integrity of our legal immigration system. That means a construction of the border wall. It means mandatory use of E-Verify for employment. It strengthens penalties for employers who violate federal employment law. It means strengthening penalties for those who illegally enter our country or illegally stay in our country. It means strong sanctions against local and state sanctuary jurisdictions. And it means fully implementing an entry-exit monitoring of visa stays. As long as that's in the bill, then we also need to address the DACA, the children who were brought here by their parents who've really never known another country. That's a difficult issue. It's an issue that we have not been able to address until we secure our borders. Otherwise, we simply encourage more of that same behavior. Once we've got the border secured, then we probably ought to grant legal residency to those who are currently enrolled in the DACA program, provide they've got no criminal convictions, misdemeanors or felonies in their background, that they're not affiliated with any criminal gangs, and they've not previously been subject to a deportation order.
Well, this is my concern, though, about the president, for instance, the prequel to last night's dinner of making a deal with Charles Schumer and Nancy Pelosi on the extension of the debt ceiling. And now he's dining alone with them talking DACA. Again, if a deal gets struck, I just fear that we're looking at Arnold Schwarzenegger writ large as president of the United States, where we could see a president who ends up moving 180 degrees away from the platform that he ran on.
Well, he was crystal clear in promising to secure our borders and restore the integrity of our legal immigration system. He was crystal clear on building a wall. Those were promises that upon which he was elected. If he were to go back on that, he would have no support anywhere in the country.
Well, I agree. I think it would be fatal to his presidency. As always, thank you so much, Congress, for coming on at Rep. McClintock, at Rep. McClintock on Twitter, Congressman Tom McClintock. Thanks for being with us, sir. Appreciate it.
Thanks again, Doug. Take care.
You're listening to Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre. Make sure you listen to McIntyre in the morning, weekdays 5 to 10 on Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.
Spotlight on the Community now resumes with Doug McIntyre.
We've got the whole Vista Del Mar, Mar Vista, Safer Streets Initiative, mm-hmm. road diets, traffic calming, congestion pricing, Vision Zero, the 2030 campaign. We got all these different campaigns, and all of them seem to have one commonality, and that is a war on private vehicles. But if the notion is that we want to make intersections safer because we are the hit-and-run capital of the North America, if not the world, we should try to do what we can to make it safer to walk or ride a bicycle or drive a car where technology is available. Well, on Canyon Drive and Bronson Avenue, neighbors came together to try to fix this long troubled intersection in the Hollywood Hills. And they couldn't get the city to do it, so they raised their own money to do it. And what happened then? Well, to talk to us about it right now, it's a pleasure to welcome to the show Alexander von Weichmeier. Alexander, how are you?
Fine. Good morning, Doug. And thank you very much for putting this story on your show. We can use the new momentum for our project. We really can after 12 years of trying to get this traffic circle built.
And we thank our pal Steve Lopez at the L.A. Times for writing about it, which brought it to our attention. So we're all flying wingman for each other. Tell us about the intersection and what the problem is.
Well, it's a very confusing configuration. It's very disorienting for both motorists and pedestrians because it's not a normal T intersection, T crossing. It's not perpendicular. It's a Bronson and Canyon sort of merge and forming a triangle-shaped intersection. So that's very unusual. And it's a big challenge for traffic engineers to make that safer or the orientation a little bit clearer, more clear than it is now. The city, in fact, has experimented with different designs using, you know, these white 2-foot tall pylons, you know, to mark possible medians. And when we back in 2005 came up with the traffic circle idea, they embraced that immediately and said that's a really great idea.
So, well, then why 12 years later are you still fighting over it?
Well, I think that's because the city is so disoriented, disorganized, unbelievably disorganized when it comes to a project like that, especially when there's so many agencies involved, like in this case, you know, obviously Department of Transportation, Bureau of Engineering, Street Services, Street Lighting, Water and Power. And I have to say, all the administrators that we talked to over the years, being very knowledgeable about the rules and regulations that govern their work, were very, very supportive and willing to help us by sharing their insight and the process that we had to go through and giving us tips of how to best to proceed. The problem is the coordination between those administrators and between those agencies.
Now, give us a little background. There have literally been lives lost at this intersection.
No, no, not at the intersection directly, but there have been several accidents, and the one accident, a fatal accident, actually ultimately fatal accident, that triggered this whole project was back in 2005 when someone ran into this group of pylons that I just mentioned and then continued further up on Canyon and hit a retaining wall in front of my home, and he died on the scene.
Well, that's obviously a tragedy. So you and your neighbors, the city wouldn't act, so you went and raised money and said, well, we'll do it ourselves. And,
yes.
And then what happened?
Well, then, you know, of course, we saw the recession, and it was really difficult for us to raise that money. It took us actually 5 years to reach our fundraising goal, which was $70,000. Once we had reached that goal, we were basically ready to submit our plans. We looked for an engineer to prepare the plans and all that. And then we suddenly learned, oh, wait a minute, you have to pay permit fees of $25,000 to the city. And we said, wait a minute, permit fees? We need to pay permit fees? We're doing an improvement to a public space that is to the benefit of, you know, the community. Why would we have to pay permit fees in a case like this? And we were told, well, it's a construction project, and every construction project, you know, there's a requirement of permit fees.
And so, what were the fees?
It was $25,000.
So you needed $25,000 just for the permits?
Yes, that's what they asked, and then we contacted Tom LaBanche, who was our council member at the time.
At the time, David Ryu's district.
Can you waive those?
Right.
And he said, no, the law doesn't allow that. but I can maybe cover it with my discretionary funds.
Right.
And then he lowered the permit fees. He had them lowered to $18,500, and it took him quite a while, well over a year, ultimately to make these funds available. That was just 2 weeks before he left office.
Unbelievable.
And then the big problem happened that, you know, because of the controversy over, you know, his spending of the discretionary funds, the new council member, David Rue, decided to rescind all the discretionary funds that had been allocated.
So we're back. So we're back to 25K.
Yes.
All right. Hey, hang on one second.
No, it was not back to 25K. No. It was still the $18,500.
Okay.
But we had to apply for it, and his discretionary funds group actually then approved them in November of 2015.
All right, so we're back to square one. David Rue came in. There was controversy over discretionary funds lowering the permits fees, which are outrageous. I have no idea in the world why it should cost $25,000 or $18,000 and change to get permits for a project. Why? What does the city say costs that much money?
Well, they have a formula that dictates that, and I think it's basically a compensation for the time for plan checking and for inspection of the actual construction site once the construction has begun.
Yeah, but who do they have inspecting it? LeBron James? I mean, who's we're talking about a traffic circle. We're not talking about building a high-rise apartment building. You got a $70,000 project with $18,000 in permit fees?
Yeah. I cannot agree no more with you. And here's the story. Once we were ready to submit our plans and the $18,500 in discretionary funds had been reapproved, the Bureau of Engineering, which is the entity that takes the plans from our engineer, said, no, we cannot accept them because the permit fees haven't been paid yet. And we said, well, wait a minute. They have been approved. They have been transferred to the Bureau of Engineering. And so we were told the money is lost. We don't know where it is.
Well,
to this day, they don't, from what I know, still have not located them.
How much has the city paid out in lawsuits in this neighborhood from people either tripping and falling or accidents or just the property damage?
I don't know that number, but you probably read what my neighbor Rob Ramsey experienced when a jogger, tripped and fell in front of his home, and his insurance company had to pay him, and the city, I think, paid a little bit too. But, that was one of those cases.
That was $190,000, and we're talking about a $70,000 project. This is just madness. Somebody at City Hall's got to hear this and read Lopez's piece and just come to the rescue and put an end to this madness. Just fix the problem and move on. I mean, life is too short. Hey, Alexander, thanks for coming on and talking to us about it. We'll follow up on the story to see where we go.
Thank you very much, Doug.
I appreciate it. Alexander von Wehrmacht. We are a borderline Tower of Babel. And, you know, we've discussed this many times. In the LAUSD system, and this is a number of years old, so the numbers could have changed. But in LAUSD, there were 97 different languages spoken in LAUSD.
How are there that many languages?
Well, how many?
97. But there's a lot more languages than 97. We now know that there's 220 languages spoken in the state of California, and that becomes a huge problem when you get into the legal system because you have to provide interpreters. So if you have somebody who speaks, you know, Urdu, and they're in court for whatever reason, now you need a translator who speaks Urdu. But what if you find somebody who speaks Urdu but doesn't speak English? You need a translator for the translator.
Wow, yeah.
And that's the situation that we find ourselves in. 44% of residents speak a language other than English at home. 7 million Californians cannot speak English well enough to understand what's going on in court. And the state's courts handle as many as 8 million cases a year. So this is a huge problem. To talk to us about this, it's a pleasure to welcome to the show from the Ventura County Superior Court, Judge Manuel Covarrubias. Judge Covarrubias, welcome aboard. How are you?
Well, good morning. Thank you very much. I'm very doing well, and thank you for this opportunity to share with you and your listeners some of the efforts that our courts are trying to address this issue of providing language access services to all the communities that we serve.
I've told this story, and it's a number of years old. It was in the pages of the L.A. Daily News, probably 10 years ago, maybe more, of a businessman on the east side of Los Angeles who was he was taking Spanish in a night school because so many of his customers spoke Spanish. But here's the rub. He spoke Korean. He was from Korea, and he wasn't taking English classes and spoke no English. So he was a Korean immigrant who was learning Spanish to do business in Los Angeles without speaking English. But that's what the courts face all the time.
In part, yes, we have a significant amount of individuals who are what we refer to as limited English proficient. And traditionally, at least up until 3 years ago, those individuals who came into court and needed an interpreter, unless they were involved in a criminal proceeding where they were facing criminal charges, potential jail time, they had to rely on having their own interpreter in any other type of proceeding, be it a civil matter, a business matter, be it a family law matter, be it an eviction proceeding. And that was an issue that's been being addressed for several years, attempted to, because, again, it was a basic due process of having a meaningful opportunity to be heard in court. And if you don't understand the language, it makes it nearly impossible to provide any type of real, true justice that's meaningful to the individual that we are attempting to serve.
And, Judge,
but we do have a significant – go ahead.
No, sorry, go ahead. You finish your point. Sorry.
No, just we have a significant amount of individuals who, for a variety of reasons, are very limited in their English. And then they come into court. Very fearful. They're uncomfortable. They're very nervous, and they're afraid to speak incorrectly because how that might impact their case, which a lot of times they just don't speak at all because they don't want to show that they don't understand. And unfortunately, many people thought when they're nodding their head, when they're speaking to them, they're saying yes, when they maybe just out of their custom and culture are nodding just to say they're polite and being respectful. But not ever want to challenge or be in conflict with the authority.
Of course, one of the issues, too, with the legal system is that there is a unique lexicon in the law. I mean, this is also true. This is one of the problems that ESL programs always have when students come into the public school system, for instance, or any school system, and they don't have a command of fundamental English. Then you get into the unique language of mathematics or science. And it's really difficult because you get words like plate tectonics or integers. Well, this is also the case, obviously, in the law, where there are just some terminology that would be difficult for people to understand if you do speak English and you're not versed in the law.
And that is one of the efforts that the court has been doing for several years now in trying to speak what we call in common English and not use some of the legal terms, but use terms that are much more in the common vernacular so that every individual can understand the proceedings. And yes, our efforts through the Language Access Plan and the task force that I've been very fortunate to be part of is to try to put those limited English proficient court users on the same level as an English-speaking person, understanding that all the terminology they're not going to be able to understand, but that's something the court and the general have been trying to focus on and using what we call everyday English terms and not using the lexicon that we talk about, the legal language and verbiage, so that individuals can understand the proceedings. Which is challenging also for interpreters, because again, they have an ethical obligation, and many people equate interpreters with someone being bilingual, which is something separate and apart. Knowing two languages doesn't necessarily equate to someone being able to become an interpreter and to make that transposition and transition from one language to another language, simultaneous and have it all correct. And so that is a ongoing issue that we address. And again, unfortunately, in the civil arenas, many of the litigants that came in would always have a family member or some friend who may know some of the language but not really understand the legal terms and be able to provide an appropriate translation for them or to the court.
We're talking with Judge Manuel Covarrubias from the Ventura County Superior Court. Judge, can we also talk about the crowded dockets that judges and courts in California face? This number is amazing, that the state's courts are handling as many as 8 million cases a year. What does that turn out to be? How many cases are on your docket or on your schedule right now, for instance?
Well, I am in a current in a heavy calendar type of assignment. Currently, I'm handling criminal cases involving cases dealing with domestic violence, elder abuse, and we also deal with a veterans court and other type of community intervention courts. So we have a high number and volume, and easily in a morning we can have 50 matters on calendar, anything from a initial appearance when they're going to be informed of their charges and attorneys are appointed to a sentencing. But again, that's it's challenging because you have to get people in, you have to get them out, but still make sure they understand the process and make sure they have their proper day in court. So it's always a balancing. We always overloaded with cases. We want to be efficient, but we also want to make sure we meet our ethical obligation to provide appropriate justice and not just treat individuals as numbers, but make sure we take the time for each case that we need. And sometimes it's a balancing act.
Yeah, it seems like it's almost an assembly line because of how crowded everything is. And when you throw language problems on top of the incredibly crowded calendar, I mean, it seems inevitable that mistakes are going to get made.
They can. That's what we always are. As part of the process that we've been involved in is also to increase the education on the area of language access and how we need to understand it, understand what the focus is of the individual and their perceptions that come to court, to provide certain skills and tools that allow you to make sure that the individual is comprehending certain things that we take for granted about everyone being can hear what's being said. When you have a crowded courtroom, you have a lot of people going on, you have attorneys there, you have the court reporter, you have the interpreters, you have the audience, and so sometimes you do have to stop and really just slow everything down to make sure the interpreter can hear what's going around them and the environment is appropriate, make sure that they are communicating well with the litigant who needs the language access services. And, yes, sometimes you have to give that up because if you do that initially, then everyone hears, they are able to follow it, and it just much more compliance that we find when people really feel that the case was given that due attention that they need and are entitled to.
What's the most obscure language that ever showed up in your courtroom?
Well, in Ventura County, we have a high agricultural population of individuals in, from different small areas in southern part of Mexico, and we deal with things such as languages that are known as indigenous languages.
Right.
And such as Mixteco and Zapoteco. And so that is very, somewhat very common for us where we need an interpreter in that language. And again, through the efforts been made through our interpreter office, they were to find an individual who is very fluent and knowledgeable in Mixteco, which again, many people believe that they look Hispanic, they maybe look, they appear to be from Mexico, they come from there, but they really do not speak any Spanish. They have their own different language and different dialects in different regions. And so we have an interpreter who's in charge and does all the work to make sure that the person's qualified. And we have, and so we'll have a relay where the individual will be speaking with the interpreter directly in Mixteco. Then the Mixteco interpreter, who speaks Spanish very well, but not English very well, we'll have another interpreter who's, again, certified in Spanish to translate what's being said from Spanish to English. And then we go back, and that's the relay interpreting. That's very common. The most challenging one I've ever had when we have someone who is deaf-mute.
Oh, man.
And the family was Spanish-speaking, and the person had really lived, grown up without any type of formal education, but he had found himself in the court system. And again, through the we're fortunate that we've had a staff interpreter for many years, know about what an intermediary is, or go out and try to set up some type of language skill through movements and motions and gestures with the family to do that. That person with deaf, who is the intermediary, who is dealing with a deaf mute. And so we had the intermediary who was a deaf mute. We had a sign language interpreter. And then we also had a Spanish language interpreter. That was probably the most challenging one I think I've ever done.
Judge, thanks so much for coming on with us. Judge Manuel Covarrubias from Ventura County Superior Court. Stuff that if you're not in a court on a regular basis, you never think about. But
wow,
what a
incredible,
challenging situation that is. Thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, a couple of weeks back, an amazing piece of video, and I don't mean amazing in a positive sense, showed up as a couple of bicyclists with GoPro cameras on their helmets took a ride through that park in Anaheim near Anaheim Stadium that has been completely taken over as a homeless encampment. And it was so shocking to so many people, it actually moved the Anaheim City Council to action, empowering the police to go in and actually start enforcing the law. Joining us right now to talk about this epidemic of homelessness in the OC is OC Supervisor Todd Spitzer. Todd, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Well, thank you. I'm great. Good morning.
So I know you've seen the video. Everybody has now. And it was just, I think for a lot of people, even those of us in L.A. who see a lot of homeless people, that was something like, that was worse than a Syrian refugee camp. There's more order and hygiene in a Syrian refugee camp than there was going on there.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the way you teed this up about Orange County, I mean, we're not used to seeing this in our county. Certainly when I drive downtown L.A., I get up to 4th Street or 1st Street off the 5, and I go to downtown. I mean, I go through Skid Row. It's been there for decades, right? But it's in a commercial area. I mean, it's not a super high residential area. And so you see it if you're going to work. But this isn't everybody's face in Orange County who goes to work. I mean, it's all along the 57 freeway.
And, of course, the homeless situation in L.A. has spread from downtown and Skid Row into suburban neighborhoods. It's out in, you know, it's out in the West San Fernando Valley. It's everywhere. There's no place.
It's everywhere. That's right.
There's no place. But it has come to Orange County. And now it seems to me that one of the major problems that we have in combating this is that law enforcement lacks the law to give them the tools they need to fight this problem, because you can only hold people on a 72-hour psych hold for 3 days. And you can't just, you know, we keep saying, well, we're not making homelessness a crime, so therefore it's legal. We've legalized vagrancy, and X percentage of a nation of a third of a billion people are going to take you up on it, even without alcohol and drug issues.
Well, let's break it down real quick. I mean, first of all, yeah, the status of homelessness is not a crime. The courts have already said that, and I actually agree with that. Society has a responsibility, I believe, to help people who want to help themselves. So I got to get rid of the criminal element in the riverbed, just like the LAPD, which I was a member of for 10 years, needs to get rid of the criminal element in Skid Row. As long as there's people selling drugs, prostitution, human trafficking, it really stops the others who want to help themselves. So we do have beds available for those who want to help themselves, but we do have a huge shortage. So the first step starting tomorrow is to get the sheriff's department into the riverbed, clear out the criminal element, and then start to move those who want to help themselves into our beds that we have available. And then we have to create this emergency, and we have to get moving quick to create more beds.
Now, yes, you have to have a place for people to go when they want to go there. That's critically important. But I guess given, Todd, and we are talking with the OC Supervisor Todd Spitzer, you can find a follow on Twitter at SUPV Todd Spitzer, Todd with two Ds, SUPV Todd Spitzer. You know, given the way we're letting everybody and his cousin out of jail and declassifying entire categories of crime from felonies to misdemeanors to infractions, I mean, what is the reality? If the cops come in on starting tomorrow and they go into the park and they arrest people because they find a couple of vials of crack, they're going to get pled down to a tap on the wrist. They'll be back. he'll be back in the park before the police officer who arrested him has finished filling out the paperwork.
Well, Doug, don't get me started on that. I was a prosecutor. I'm running for district attorney in Orange County. I was a police officer. I was a point person in the state legislature when I was in the assembly against early release. They stopped early release of prisoners, and as soon as I left the legislature in 2008, they started releasing them like cockroaches. The fact is, you don't arrest people simply because they're homeless, but you do arrest people who are criminals. And so we have a blending of horrible societal problems that's exacerbating our homeless problem. So number one, the legislature needs to get its act together and reverse some of these horrible reforms that they have allowed to happen to our society. And then number two, we have to really focus on the mentally ill and those who are addicted to drugs and alcohol in our society.
You know, Todd, when you talk about this issue, maybe more than any other issue, the complexity of this issue is, it makes me have genuine sympathy for local elected officials. Not something I often get to say on this show, but I really mean it, because look at what society is asked to fix. This is a human catastrophe. And every person who ends up on the street, while there's commonalities, everybody got there a different way. When somebody ends up living in a sleeping bag or on a cardboard pallet in a park or under a freeway overpass, they have ended up divorced from every other social connection that most people have. There's no relatives. There's no friend. There's nobody that can give you a couch for a couple of weeks till you get back on your feet, because you have severed those ties either deliberately or because your behavior became too dangerous for people to take you in anymore. And now government has to do it. And I don't know that government can ever fix this problem, because it's...
I understand. I agree. And I'm not a guy who's big on government, big government, right? I prefer the private sector to handle a lot of these issues. We did build, and we're building out, the first emergency shelter in Orange County in my district. 100 beds now, it'll have another 100 beds. It's a wraparound, right? I mean, we're providing all the services there. You know, drug addiction, behavioral health, everything you need to turn your life around. Now, I have a schizophrenic cousin, my cousin Patsy. I lived with her father when I was in law school in Northern California, going to Hastings. And she's never going to be able to work, right? She's going to be on government assistance forever. She's not capable, and she won't even take medication to be stabilized because she's paranoid. That, I believe, is the person that we have a responsibility to help. But let me tell you, Doug, there's so many people who, and you said, can't find a couch. There's people that have to take responsibility for their situation, and they're not mentally ill, and they may have a drug addiction. But see, we decriminalize drug addiction.
Right.
There are drugs in our state, right? So we can't even force people to take drug rehab anymore. Diversion, because they rather do the time in jail, which is non-existent, than take a program, which is tough, right? It's tough to take a 9-month drug detox program. So we have completely disincentivized changing human behavior in California because the liberal legislature has made sure that we are making our situation worse on our streets.
Okay.
Because that's what liberals do. They don't make people take any responsibility for their own situation.
Todd, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it. Again, on Twitter at SoupV, Todd Spitzer. This has been Spotlight on the Community, 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre, Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.